Lorraine took me back again, put its arms around me and held tight. And I started to put the pieces together. You could say it started with Berga. She wasn't the girl in the headlights any longer. She was younger. A tall, luscious Viking with eyes that could draw a man. She was a blonde snare with a body full of playful curves that held out triple challenges. A body filled with dares to be taken up. She was coming home from a visit to Italy. And in the hidden hours on board, she had found a person who was ready to call the dare. He wasn't a special kind of man. He was a guy with a small export business who could pass unnoticed in the crowd. He was a guy with a legitimate excuse to travel at certain times. He was a guy who was part of a great plan. A guy named Nicholas Raymond, who really wasn't anything at all, and because of it was the only one they used as a messenger to bring the stuff over. But he had a fault, and because of it a lot of people died. He liked the women. And Berger was special. He liked her so much he never followed the plan of delivery through and made plans to use the stuff himself. He and Berger. $2 million after conversion. Someplace the stuff was still there. Maybe it took a long time to find him again. Or maybe they wanted the stuff first and were afraid the secret would die with him. However it was, it took him a while to die. Maybe they thought Berger had it then. And she died. That put it on me. I was thinking of something then. Horror, terror, fear. All of it that was there in her face for a little while. A confusion of emotions that stopped too suddenly. I cursed to myself as the minute details started to fall into place. Spun around and yelled at a cab. He was hardly stopped before I had the door open. I told him where to take me and sat on the edge of the seat until we got there. The elevator took me to my office. I got out, jangling the keys in my hand, stuck one in the lock and turned it. It was on my desk, under the stapler with the top under the flap of the envelope. I turned it over and saw the trade name of a gasoline company. It was a simple message, one line. The way to a man's heart. And under it, the initials B.T. Berger must have scribbled it at the service station after lifting the address from the registration tacked to the steering post. But it was the old address. The new one was on the back, out of sight, and she hadn't seen the lines drawn through the words that voided it. I looked at it, remembering her face again, and knew what she was thinking when she wrote it. I never heard the door open behind me. He stood in the doorway of my inner office and said, "I trust you can make something out of it. We couldn't." I knew he had a gun without looking. I knew there were more of them without seeing them, and I didn't give a damn because I knew the voice. I knew the voice, and it was the one I said I'd never forget. The last time it spoke, I was supposed to die, and before it could speak again, I let out a crazy sound of hate that filled the room, and was at them in a crouch with a bullet spitting over my head. I had the guy in my hands, feeling my fingers tear his eyes loose while he screamed his lungs out, and even the gun pounding on the back of my skull didn't stop me. I had enough left to lash out with my foot and hear it bite into flesh and bone, and enough left to do something to one of them that turned his stomach inside out in my face. The horrible choked scream of anguish one was letting out on the floor diminished to a whimper before disappearing altogether in the blackness that was closing in around me. Far in the distance, I thought I heard sharp, flat sounds and a voice swearing hoarsely. Then I heard nothing at all. It was a room. It had one window high off the floor, and you could see the pinpoints that were stars through the film of dirt on the glass. I was spread-eagled on the bed with my hands and legs pulled tight to the frame, and when I tried to twist, the ropes bit into my skin and burned like acid. The muscles in my side had knotted in pain over ribs that were torturous hands gripping my chest. I had to think. There had to be a gimmick somewhere, and I had to find it. I could see the outlines of the bed and feel the ropes that tied me to the steel frame. It was one of those fold-away things with a heavy innerspring mattress, and I was laced down so tightly my hands dented the rolled edges of it. I looked down at my toes, over my head at my hands, and took the only way out. There was noise to it, time involved, and pressures that started the blood flowing down my wrists. I rocked the bed sideways until it teetered on edge, then held my breath as it tipped. I hit the floor, and the thing came halfway over on top of me before it slithered back on its side. The mattress had pulled out from under my feet, and when I kicked around, I got the lower half entirely free of the springs. I had to stop and get my breath. Then, when I tried the second time, I had the play in the ropes that I needed. They were wet and slippery with my own blood. The blood did it. I tugged and felt one come free, the next one, and my hand was loose. It only took a few minutes longer to get the other one off, and my feet off the end of the bed, and I was standing up with my heart trying to pound the shock away and the pain back in place. I didn't let it get that far. I was half drugged with exertion, but I knew what I had to do. I put the bed back on its legs, spread the mattress out, and got back the way I had been. I was able to dummy the ropes around both feet and one hand, and I hoped they wouldn't see the one I couldn't get to. Time. Now I could use a little time. Every second of it put strength back in my body. I lay there with my eyes closed. I tried to bring the picture back into focus and got part of it. I got Berger and Nicholas Raymond and a guy pushing him into the path of a truck. I was thinking that if they had pulled an autopsy on the body, they would have found a jug full of stuff in his veins that made him a walking automaton. The picture got just a little clearer, and I could see the work they did on Berger. Oh, it had to be easy. With $2 million in the bag, you don't barge around until you're sure what you're doing. First, they tried to scare her. Then came the big con job. Carl Ivello, the man about town, putting on the heavy rush act, trying to get close enough to the babe to see what she knew. She had hired a bodyguard. That didn't work. But she still wouldn't let go of what she knew, because as soon as she did, she'd be dead. Maybe she saw her way out of it when Uncle Sam put the squeeze on Ivello. Maybe she thought with him away, she'd have a chance. If she did, she thought wrong. They still got to her. Then I heard voices outside. Two of them were bragging that I'd be ready to spill my guts, and the third one said I'd better be. It was a quiet voice that wasn't a bit new to me. It said, "Wait here, and I'll see. You want us to come in, boss? He might need some softening." "If he does, I'll call." "Okay, boss." Chairs rasped against the floor as the door opened. There was no light, but a candle in a bottle was on the chair, and he lit it. "Hello, Carl." "The infamous Mike Hammer. You did a lot of legwork for us. I hear you blundered right on what we've been looking for." I didn't say anything. "Where is it?" I let my eyes come open. "Let her go first." He gave me that twisted grin. "I'm not trading for her. Funny enough, I don't even know where she is. You see, she wasn't part of my department." "The hell with you." He leaned a little bit closer. "One of the boys is a knife man. He likes to do things with a knife. Maybe you can remember what he did to Berger Torn." His smile got uglier as he said, "That isn't even a little bit what he'll do to you." The yell that started in my throat choked off, and I mumbled something Carl seemed to want to hear, and he bent forward saying, "What? What?" And that repeated question was the last Carl Ivello ever spoke again, because he got too close. And there were my hands around his throat, squeezing so hard his flesh buried my fingers, while his eyes were hard little marbles trying to roll out of their sockets. I squeezed and pushed him on his knees, and there wasn't any sound at all. I got him on the bed. I spread him out the way I had been, let him lie there. The joke was too good to pass up, so Carl lived a minute longer than he should have. I tried to make my voice as close to his as I could, and I called to the door. "He talked. Now put him away." Outside the door, a chair scraped back. There was a single spoken word, silence, and the slow shuffle of footsteps coming toward the door. He didn't even look at me. He walked up to the bed, and I could hear the snick as the knife opened. The boy was good. He didn't drive it in. He put it in position and pushed. Carl's body arched, trembled, And as I stepped toward the candle, the boy saw the mistake and knew he'd made his last one. I put everything I could find into the swing that caught the side of his neck and mashed his vertebrae into his spinal cord, and he was dead before I eased him to the floor. Cute. Getting cuter all the time. I came out of the door with a yell and dived at the guy at the table. His frenzied stare cost him the second he needed to clear his rod, and while he was still digging for it, my fingers were ripping into his face, and my body smashed him right out of the chair. The gun hit the floor and bounced across the room, and he had to watch everything I did to him until his eyes filmed over and blanked out when the back of his head cracked against the floor. And then I left. I got out on the street and let the rain wash me clean. Down the street, lights of a diner threw a yellow blob on the sidewalks. I walked toward it, stood outside the door a second, looking at the two drunks and the guy with the trombone case perched on the stools. There wasn't any more I could lose, so I walked in, called the counterman over, and tossed my watch on the counter. I need a dime. You can hold my watch?
For a dime? Mac, are you nuts? Look, if you need some coffee, say so.
I don't need coffee. I want to make a phone call. His eyes went up and down me, and his mouth rounded into a silent, oh.
You've been rolled, huh?
He fished in his pocket, tossed a dime on the counter, and pushed my watch back to me.
Go ahead, Mac. I know how it is.
Pat wasn't at home. My dime clinked back, and I tried his office. He wasn't there, either. The cop on the board wanted to take a message, and the captain would take care of it when he came in. I said, pal, this kind of message won't wait. It's something he's been working on. And if I can't get word to him right away, he's going to hit the roof. There was a hurried exchange of murmurs. And then I heard,
we'll try to contact the captain by radio. Can you leave your phone number?
I read it off the dial, told him I'd wait, and hung up. The counterman was still watching me. There was a steaming hot cup of coffee by an empty stool with a half pack of butts lying alongside it. The guy grinned, nodded to the coffee, and made himself a friend. I sat there a while, feeling pretty shaky, and Pat walked in. Tired lines around his eyes, his face set in a frozen expression. He came over and sat down.
Who kicked the crap out of you, Mike?
I looked that bad.
You're a mess, he said.
They reached me, but they didn't hold on to me, chum.
Yeah, I have all hell breaking loose around my ears.
Ivello's sister came to us with a list of phone calls yesterday, and we tracked down the names into some of the damnedest places you ever saw. We have some of the wheels in the mafia dangling by their you-know-whats, and they're scrambling for cover.
How about Billy Mist, I asked him.
Nothing doing. Not a word on him so far. He can't be located anyway. You mentioned a woman who went to see Berger Torn. He gave a slow nod, his hands opening and closing slowly.
We still can't make her.
Could it have been a man dressed as a woman?
It could have been anything. There was no accurate description and no record of it. And the stuff Raymond was hiding is still missing.
I know where it is. Pat's head came around fast. 2 million turned into 4 just by sitting there. Inflation.
Damn it, Mike, where?
On the good ship Cedric. Our friend Al Afia was working on the deal. He had all the plans in his dive, and whoever killed him walked off with them.
Now you tell me, he said. Now you spill it when somebody has had time to dig it loose.
It's not that easy, Pat. Al had those plans a long time. I'm even beginning to know why he was bumped. Pat waited me out. He tried to sucker Velda into his dump for a fast play at her. She slipped him a dose of Chlorol, and while he was out, started turning the place upside down. Al didn't stay out very long. He got sick, came to, and saw what she was doing. Velda used the bottle on him then. It cut his head, and he staggered out after she left and got word to somebody. That somebody caught the deal in a hurry, and someplace she's still sweating. I hope. The pain throughout my body swelled to agony. Later, this somebody iced out to get rid of the only person who knew where she was. I reached for the last butt in the pack. He wants those narcotics in the worst way, and I know how to get the stuff. Berger passed a clue to me before she died, and I've been sitting on it all this time. If I have to, I'll use it to ransom Velda. I rubbed at the ache in my side.
The stuff is on the Cedric. All you have to do is find the ship. The records will tell you the stateroom Raymond used. When you've got it, call Ray Diker at the Globe and give him first crack at the yarn. Tell him to hold the story until I call you. By then, I'll have Velda. I went out and walked down the street and let the rain hit me in the face. There weren't any cabs outside, and I walked to my apartment, hardly conscious of the protest my body was setting up. I felt my legs starting to go when I reached the door, and the super and his wife took a startled look at me and helped me inside. Lily Carver came up out of the chair. Her eyes went soft, reflected the hurt mine were showing. Then she had my hand and helped me into the bedroom. The super followed us in. "You want me to call a doctor, Mr. Hammer?" I shook my head. "I'll be okay." A woman was here. Friday, her name was. She left you a note in an envelope and said it was pretty important. She wanted you to see it as soon as you came in. He handed it to me and I read it. "Dear Mike, I found the list. Your friend has it. I found something much more important, too, and must see you at once. Please call me at once. Love, Michael." Then sleep came. There was a face in it. The face had a wet red mouth, full and soft. It kept coming closer, opening slowly. It was Michael, and in my dream I grinned at her, fascinated by her lips. I got up, showered, dressed. I could hear things frying when I got on the phone and dialed Michael Friday's number. The voice wasn't Michael's, or any woman's. It said,
"Mr. Rivallo's residence."
But the voice wore a badge. "Mike Hammer, I'm looking for Michael Friday. Carl's sister, she there?"
"She isn't here. She disappeared. She came back here after she left headquarters the other day, stayed a couple of hours, and grabbed a cab into Manhattan."
"She was coming to see me. I was out. She left a note and took off again. That's why I called her place."
"I'll be damned. We checked all over the city to find out where she went to."
"If she's using cabs, maybe you can pick her up from when she left here."
"Sure, sure. I'll pass it along."
The phone went dead, and I socked it back in its hanger. Lily called me from the kitchen, and I went out and sat down. It was quite a spread, but my gut tried to sour at the sight of it. All I could think of was another one gone. Another kid cut down by a pack of scrammy hoods who wanted that $2 million worth of hell so bad they'd kill and kill and kill until they had every bit of it. I sat there, full of bitter hate and bile, until she spoke. "Please, eat something, Mike." "I can't, kid. Not now."
"You have to get something in your stomach."
Her words sent something racing up my back.
It was a feeling you get when you know you have something and you can't wait to get it out of you.
I was working on it when the phone rang. I grabbed it and Pat barked a short hello. I asked him, "Did you find Friday?"
"We didn't find a damn thing. Nothing. Got that? No Friday, no Hop, no nothing. The feds are cutting a swath through the racket a mile wide and we still haven't come up with the stuff."
"What about the Cedric?" Pat cursed under his breath.
"It's screwballed, Mike. The Cedric's in a Jersey port right now, undergoing repairs. She was a small liner before the war and was revamped to carry troops. All the staterooms were torn out of her and junked to make her over into a transport. The stuff might have been there once, but it's been gone a long time now. None of this should have happened at all."
Lily's fingers kept pushing the silken strands away from her eyes while she watched me. I said, "Get your coat."
"They'll be waiting for us outside?"
"That's right. They'll be waiting." We didn't go down the stairs. We went up to the roof and crossed the abutments between buildings. About 100 yards down, we entered another building and took the stairs down to the basement. From there, we got out the back way and circled the block to the garage. Sammy was just coming on duty and waved my way when he saw us. It was a funny kind of wave, with the motion of the other hand under it. I pushed Lily in ahead of me and closed the door. Sammy didn't know whether to laugh or not. He decided not to and wrinkled up his face in a serious expression. He said, "You hot, Mike?" "In a way, I'm boiling. Why?"
"People have been around here asking about your new heap. One of the boys tipped me there's eyes watching for it."
"Can you get me a car?" I asked.
"Well, take mine. I figured you'd be asking, so I have it by the door, nosing out. It's a good load, and I like it, so bring it back in one piece." He pulled down the blind over the window and followed us into the garage. He hauled the door up, grinned unhappily when we pulled out, and let it slam back in place. I told Lily to get down until I was sure we were clear, made a few turns around one-way streets, parked for a few minutes watching for lights, then pulled out again and cut into traffic. Lily said, "Where are we going, Mike?"
"You'll see."
"Mike, please. I'm awfully scared."
Her lower lip matched the flutter of her voice. She sat there pinching her hands together, her arms making jerky movements against her sides to control the shudder that was trying to take hold of her body.
"Sorry, kid," I told her. "You're as much a part of this as I am. You ought to know about it. Michael Friday stooled on her brother. She went back home and found something else, but this time she was afraid to give it to the police."
"Mike."
"Let me talk, kid. I'm just getting it in order. There was trouble in the outfit. Carl was expecting to take over somehow. In that outfit, you don't work your way up. Carl was expecting to move up a slot so somebody else had to go. That boy knew what he was doing. He spent some time getting something on the one he was after, and he was going to smear him with it." I put it through my mind again. Carl was close enough to start the thing going so the other one knew about it. He went after what Carl had and found it gone. By that time, the cops were having a field day with the labor department of the organization, so he had a good idea who was responsible. He must have tailed her. He knew she had it, and what she was going to do with it, so he nailed her.
"But who, Mike, who?"
My teeth came apart in the kind of smile nobody seemed to like. I was feeling good all over because I had my finger on it now, and I wasn't letting go.
"Friend Billy," I said.
Billy missed. Now he sits quiet and enjoys his supper. Someplace he's got a dame on the hook and enjoying life, because whatever it was Carl had isn't anymore. Billy's free as a bird, but he hasn't got $2 million in the bush to play with. He's got an ace in the hole with Velda in case the $2 million shows up, and a deuce he can discard any time if it doesn't. The greasy punk is sitting pretty where he can't be touched. The laugh started out of my chest and ripped through my throat. It was the biggest joke I ever laughed at because the whole play was made to block me out and I wasn't being mousetrapped. I was going back a couple of hours to the kitchen and what Lily had said, and back even further to a note left in my office. Then, so I wouldn't forget how I felt right there at the beginning, I went back to Berga and the way she had looked coming out of the gas station. I pointed the hood toward the building with the efficient look and antiseptic smell and pulled in behind a city hearse unloading a double cargo. The attendant in the morgue called me into his office and wanted to know if I wanted coffee. I shook my head.
"It takes the smell away," he said. "What can I do for you?"
"You had a body here, a girl named Berga Torn."
"Still have it."
"Slated for autopsy?"
"Nope. At least I haven't heard about it. They don't usually in those cases."
"There will be one in this case. Can I use the phone?"
"Go ahead."
I picked it up and dialed headquarters. Pat wasn't around, so I tried his apartment. He wasn't there either. The door of the office opened, and the little guy with the potbelly came in and dropped his bag on the floor.
"Damn it, Charlie, why can't people wait until morning to die?"
I said, "Hi, Doc." And the coroner gave me a glance that wasn't any too pleased.
"Hello, Hammer. What are you doing here?"
"I need you for a job that can't wait. I have to chop corners and it has to be quick."
"What are you talking about?"
I stepped closer. "Suppose you had a chance to do something except listen for a heartbeat that isn't there for a change. Suppose you had it in your hand to kick a few killers right into the chair. Suppose you're the guy who stands between a few more people living or dying in the next few hours. How would you pitch it, Doc?" The puzzle twisted his nose into a ridge of wrinkles.
"See here, you're talking like..."
"I'm talking plain. I've been trying to get official backing for what I have in mind, but nobody's home. Even then, it might take up time we can't spare. The chance I was talking about is in your hands, Doc."
"But what..."
I cut in. "I need a stomach autopsy on a corpse. Now."
"Can do?"
The coroner squared his shoulders, let a little excitement trickle into his eyes, and he nodded. "Berga Torn," I told the attendant. "Let's go see her."
He did it the fast, easy way you do when you cut corners. He did it right there in the carrier she lay on, and the light overhead winked on the steel in his hand. I didn't get past the first glimpse because fire does horrible things to a person, and it was nicer to remember Berga in the headlights of the car. I could hear him, though. I could tell when he found it. He did me the favor of cleaning it before he handed it to me, and I stood there looking at the dull glitter of the brass key. I could see City Athletic Club, 529, scratched into the surface, and I squeezed his arm so hard he winced through his grin. I said, "Listen, get on the phone out there and find Captain Chambers. Tell him I found who we're looking for, and I'm going after it. I'm not taking any chances on this getting away so we can hop up to my office for a print of this thing. I'll call back to see how you made out. And someday I'll let you know just how much a boost up you gave the department." Lily knew I had it when I came bouncing down the stairs. She opened the door for me and said, "Mike?" "I know almost all the answers now, chicken." I held up the key. "Here's the big baby. Look at it. A chunk of metal people have died for, and all this time it was in the stomach of a girl who was ready to do anything to beat them out of it. The key to the deal. For the first time in my life, a real one. I know who had it, and what's behind the door it opens." I got the heap going and turned south on 9th Avenue, staying in tempo with the lights until I reached the gray brick building with the small neon sign that read, "City Athletic Club." I cut the engine in front of the door and went to get out. Lily said, "Mike, will you be long?" "Couple of minutes." Her face seemed to be all pinched up. "What's the matter, kid?"
"Cold, I guess."
I pulled the blanket from the seat in the back and draped it over her shoulders. "You're catching something, sure as hell. Keep it around you. I'll be right back." She shivered and nodded, holding the edges of the blanket together under her chin. The guy at the reception desk was a sleepy-eyed tall guy who sat there hating everybody who bothered him. He watched me cross the hall and looked at the key when I held it up. "What's the key for?" "Locker room. See who has 529. He curled his lip at me and pulled a ledger out of the desk drawer. "Raymond, 10-year membership. Let's go." I followed him down to the locker room and found 529. I stuck the key in, turned it, and the lock came apart. Death, crime, and corruption were lying on the floor in two metal containers the size of lunch pails. The seams were welded shut, and the units painted a deep green. Attached to each was the cutest little rig you ever saw, a small CO2 bottle with a heavy rubber ball attached to the nozzle. The rubber was rotted in the folds, and the hose connection had cracked dry, but it didn't spoil the picture any. All you had to do was toss the unit out of a porthole. The bottle stopper opened after a time interval, and the stuff floated to the top where the rubber ball buoyed it until it was picked up. The answer to the Cedric was there, too. A short story composed of sail slips stapled together. A yarn that said Raimundo had taken good care of his investment and was on hand to pick up the junk when they stripped the ship. There was one special item marked wall ventilators, $12.50 each, $25 total. I shut the door and closed the lock through the hasp. It had been there a lot of years. A few more hours wouldn't hurt it any. But now I had something I could talk a trade with. I could describe the stuff so they'd be sure, and it would be my way all the way. My watch read 5 minutes to three. Time, time, time. The rain was a solid sheet blasting the sidewalks and spraying back into the air again. I yelled for Lily to open the door, made a dash for it, and slid aboard. She trembled under the gust of cold air that got in with me, her face set tighter than it was before. I reached over and put my arm around her shoulders. She was pulled tight as a drumhead, a muscular stiffness that made her whole body almost immobile. "Cripes, Lily, I gotta get you to a doctor."
"No. Just get me where it's warm, Mike."
"I haven't got much sense," I said. She forced a smile.
"I really don't mind, as long as you..."
"No more chasing around, kid. I've found it. I can take you back now." There was a catch in the sob that came out of her. Her eyes glistened and the smile didn't have to be forced. "You'll go back to my apartment, kid. dry off and sit tight.
Alone?
Don't worry about it. There are cops stationed around the building. I'll tip them to keep the place well covered. Now, I've got to get a copy of this key made, and you're hanging on to it until Captain Chambers picks it up. My friend turned out the key while he swore at the world for getting him out of bed, so I left him to buy a good night in a gin mill for his trouble. We reached my block at 3:45, with the rain still lashing the car in frenzied bursts. There was a patrol wagon at each end, and two plainclothesmen were standing in the doorway. When they saw us, they looked so mad they could burst. I didn't give them a chance to ask questions. I got Lily inside, saw her through the front door with the cop beside her, and felt the load go lighter. Now I had one more person to see. When I reached the apartment building, I didn't push any bells to be let in. I kicked out a pane of glass on the inside door, reached through the hole, and turned the knob. I went up the stairs to the same spot I'd been before, and this time I did hit the bell. Billy Mist was expecting somebody, but it wasn't me. He was all dressed except for his jacket, and he had a gun slung in a harness under his shoulder. I rammed the door so hard it kicked him back in the room, and while he was reaching for his rod, I smashed his nose into a mess of bloody tissue. He made a second try while he was on the floor, and this time I kicked the gun out of his hand under the table and picked him up to go over him good. I held him out where I wanted him and put one into his ribs that brought a scream choking up his throat, and had the next one ready when Billy Mist died. Billy Mist, who knew where Velda was. Billy Mist, who was going to talk before he died. Billy Mist, who was going to give me the pleasure of killing him slowly. It was thinking of Velda that smoothed it. My hands stopped shaking and my mind started thinking again. I looked around the mess I had made of the place, avoiding the eyes on the floor. Billy had been packing. The one suitcase had a week's supply of clothes in it, but he could afford to buy more when he got there because the rest of the space was taken up by packets of new bills. I was picking the stuff apart when I heard them at the door. Not cops, not these boys. They wanted in because I was there, and nothing was stopping them. Shoulders slammed into the door, and a vertical crack showed in it. I picked up Billy's rod and pumped 5 fast ones through the wood, belly high, and the screams made a deafening cacophony that brought more screams from others in the building. The door cracked again, started to buckle, and I turned and ran into the bathroom. I got my feet on the sill, started to go through when my arm swept the bottles from the shelf, dozens of bottles. There was one my arm didn't touch, and I picked it up. I stared at it, swore lightly, and dropped it in my pocket. The front door let loose. I could hear shots and shrieks that didn't belong there. I crawled through the window before I could find out where they came from. I felt along the ledge with my toes, leaning forward at an angle with my hands resting on the building on the other side of the airway. I made the end where the building joined, found handholds on the other sills, and went up. They never found me. I went down the fire escape of the next building, hit the yard, and got out of there. Sirens were converging on the place, and 100 yards off I could hear the rapid belch of a Tommy gun. I laughed my fool head off while I stood there on the sidewalk and felt good about it. In a way, it paid to be stupid as long as you overdid it. I was too stupid to figure the boys planted around my apartment would follow me, and too stupid to remember there were the Washington boys right behind them. I pulled the pill bottle out of my pocket, looked at the label again, and threw it away. One more stop. The office was dark, nobody at the desk, no beautiful smile, challenging eyes. I knew where to look and pulled the file out. I held a match to it and the pieces clicked in place. I put the card back and went through the rooms. Off the inner office, a door led to stairs that ran up, thickly carpeted stairs that didn't betray the passage of a person. There was a door at the top and an apartment off it. I walked away from the door that showed light. The other door was locked. But those locks had never given me any trouble at all. I stepped inside, eased the door shut, and flicked my lighter. She was laced into an easy chair with a straitjacket, her legs tied down. A strip of adhesive tape across her mouth, and around her mouth red marks where other tapes had been ripped off to feed her or hear what she had to say. There was a fearful, shrunken look about her face, but her eyes were alive. They couldn't see me behind the lighter, but they cursed me just the same. I said, "Hello, Velda." and the cursing stopped. The eyes didn't believe until I moved the lighter and the tears wiped out her vision. I got her loose, and she pressed against me, tears wetting my face. I squeezed her, whispered things to her. I found her mouth and tasted her, deeply, loving the way she held me and the things she said without really saying anything. When I could, I said, "You all right? I was going to die tonight. Somebody will take your place." I found the key in my pocket and pressed it in her hand. I gave her my wallet to go with it and pulled her to the door. "Take a cab and find yourself a cop. Find Pat if you can. There's an address on that key. Go hold what's in the locker it opens. Tomorrow we'll talk." "Tomorrow, Mike. It's crazy this way. I find you and I'm sending you off again. Damn it, move before I don't let you go." I waited until she had gone down the steps, and this time I walked the other way, to where the light showed. I pushed it open, leaned against the sill, and when the gray-haired man writing at the table across the room spun around, I said, "Dr. Soberin, I presume?" It caught him so far off base I had time to get halfway across to him before he dipped his hand in the drawer, and I had his wrist before he could get the thing leveled. I let him keep the gun in his hand so I could bend it back and hear his fingers break. I shoved him away from me, slashed the butt end of the rod across the side of his head, and watched him drop. "I got me a wheel," I said. "The boy at the top." Dr. Soberin opened his mouth to speak, and I shook my head. "A gimmick, Doc. There's always that damn gimmick. The kind you can't kick out of sight. This time, the gimmick was on the bottom of that card your secretary made out on Berga Torn. She asked who sent her, and she said William Mist. She signed the card, too. You knew there might be an investigation and didn't want any suspicious erasures on the card, so you simply dug up a name you could type over Mist to make the letters fit. Wheaton comes out pretty well. Unless you looked hard, you'd never pick it up." He had gone deathly pale. The hand with the broken fingers looked unreal on the end of his arm. Unreal and painful. "You took a lot of trouble to get the information Berga had under her hat. A lot of clever thinking went into that deal at the sanitarium. Sorry I spoiled your plans. You shouldn't have wrecked my heap." Something childish crept into his face. You got another one." "I'll keep it, too. I didn't go for the booby trap, Doc. That was kid stuff." If his face screwed up any tighter, he was going to cry. He sat there moaning softly, rocking in his chair. "This time I do it your way," I said. "I was the only one you were ever afraid of, because I was like the men you give orders to. I'm not going to talk to you. Later I'll give my explanations and excuses to the police. Later I'll get raked over the coals for what I'm going to do now. But what the hell?" He was quiet in his chair, the quiet that terror brings, and for once he was knowing the hand of terror himself. I said, "Doc," and he looked at me. No, not me, the gun. The big hole at the end of the gun. And while he was looking, I let him see what came out of the gun. I stepped over the body and picked up the phone. I called headquarters and tried to get Pat. He was still out. I had the call transferred to another department, and the man I wanted said hello. I asked him if they had identification on a dead blonde, and he told me to wait. A minute later, he picked up the phone.
"Think I got it. Death by drowning. Age about..."
"Skip the details. Just the name."
"Lily Carver. Prince just came in from Washington. She had him taken while she worked at a war plant."
I said thanks, held the button down, and let it go. When I heard the dial tone, I started working my home number. She said,
"Don't bother, Mike. I'm right here."
And she was. Beautiful Lily with hair as white as snow. Her mouth a scarlet curve that smiled. Her body a tight bundle of lush curves under a light white terry cloth robe. Lovely Lily, who brought the sharpness of an alcohol bath in with her. Gorgeous Lily, with my .45 in her hand from where she'd found it in the dresser.
"You almost forgot about me, Mike."
I almost did, didn't I? There was cold hate coming into her eyes now, hate that grew as she looked again at the body beside the table.
"You shouldn't have done that, Mike."
"No?" She shook her head.
He was the only one who knew about me. I loved him. He knew about me and didn't care. I loved him, you crumb.
I looked at her the way I did when she first held a gun on me. Sure. You loved him so much you killed Lily Carver and took her place. You loved him so much you made sure there were no slips in his plan. You loved him so much you set Berger Torn up for the kill and damn near made sure Velda died. You loved him so much that you never saw that all he loved was power and money, and you were only something he could use. You reached Al after Velda left, but you had time to catch up to her. Billy knew what had happened when you called him down to tell him that his girlfriend wasn't what she was cracked up to be. With that, Billy didn't go, and he carved up his playmate, Al. Nice people to have around.
Shut up.
Shut up, hell. You stuck with me all the way. You ducked out once because you thought the boys had me. Then came back when you found out I propped them up against the dead-end sign. You passed the word right under my nose and had Billy packing to blow town. I even showed you how to get out of the apartment without a tail picking you up. That's why you're here now. So what was supposed to happen? You go back to your real identity? Nuts. What kind of a guy do you think I am, anyway? Her face changed as if I had slapped her. For an instant, the strangeness was back again.
You're a deadly man, Mike.
Then I saw it in her face, and she was faster than I was. The rod belched flame, and the slug tore into my side and spun me around. There was a crazy spinning sensation, a feeling of tumbling end over end in space. My eyes cleared, and I pushed myself up on my elbow. There was a loose, empty feeling in my joints. The end was right there ahead of me, and nothing I could do about it. Lily smiled again, the end of the 45 drifting down to my belly. My mouth was dry. I wanted a cigarette. It was something a guy about to die always got. My fingers found the deck of Lucky's, fumbled one loose, and got it into my mouth.
You shouldn't have killed him, Lily said.
I reached for my lighter. It wasn't going to be long now. One shot. Quick. The alcohol scent was stronger. She was very close.
I thought I almost loved you once, Mike. More than him. But he would take me like I was. He was the doctor. I was the patient. I loved him. You would have been disgusted with me. Look at me, Mike. How would you like to kiss me now? You wanted to before. I wanted you to. I was afraid to let you touch me. You wanted to kiss me, so kiss me.
Her fingers slipped slowly through the belt of the robe, opened it. Her free hand parted it slowly, until I could see what she was really like. I felt my belly retching. She was a horrible caricature of a human. There was no skin, just a disgusting mass of twisted, puckered flesh from her knees to her neck, making a picture of gruesome freakishness that made you want to shut your eyes against it. The cigarette almost fell from my mouth. The lighter shook in my hand, but I got it open.
Fire did it, Mike. Do you think I'm pretty now?
She laughed, and I heard the insanity in it. The gun pressed into my belt as she leaned forward, bringing the revulsion and the pungent alcohol smell with her.
You're going to die now, but first you can do it. Deadly. Deadly. Kiss me.
The smile never left her mouth, and before it was on me, I thumbed the lighter. And in the moment of time before the scream blossomed into the wild cry of terror, she was a mass of flame, tumbling on the floor with the blue flames of alcohol turning the white of her hair into black char, and her body convulsing under the agony of it. The flames were teeth that ate, ripping and tearing into scars of other flames, and her voice the shrill sound of death on the loose. I looked away. The door was closed, and maybe I had enough left to make it.
Kiss Me Deadly was written by Mickey Spillane and performed by Stacy Keach. It was abridged for audio by Jan Werner. Original music by Percy France. The program was recorded and edited by Karen Perlman. Steven Erickson was the post-production and mix engineer. The associate producer was Linda Ross. Kiss Me Deadly was directed and produced by Karen Frohman. If you enjoyed this audio program, look for more Simon & Schuster productions at your local bookstore or record store. To order by mail, fill out the enclosed order form and mail it back in the postpaid envelope provided. Or for faster service, call our toll-free number, 1-800-678-2677.